Also, it's Independence Day here in the States.
Indeed it is.
Yeah. And there are three things people like in America that make up the American way. Truth, justice, and sex. And we're here to talk about one of those things today.
I am a fan of all three. Excellent.
This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And there's been a lot going on this week. I don't know if those of you who listen to Ask an Atheist regularly have seen the blog site, but our own very own Mike Gillis wrote a article sort of in response to the responses we got for last week's episode.
Yes.
Yep. Boy, yeah, that was fantastic.
It was a really good, very brief and to the point and very well-reasoned and clearly stated little article on our blog, and it ended up going viral.
Yeah.
Reddit. Yeah.
Reddit. Yeah, I mean, it was the hits to the website were bigger almost than the Rapture Relief thing, or the Rapture Party we did.
Yeah.
And to those of you listening to us because you found that article, again, you're welcome to call in today, 253-584-1480. And we skipped it last week because there was no news, but unfortunately there's news this week, and it is now 109 days till the end of the world. And we have a related article with a local field. This comes to us from the Seattle PI, and it's the Rapture Ribbing May Have Led to Shooting. The world did not end on May 21st, but on Friday it came closer to ending than Jerry Andrews ever wanted. Andrews was shot in the shoulder at a Eugene, Oregon hydraulic shop on Friday. The accused shooter is a coworker who would believe that the rapture would occur on May 21st. It didn't, and his coworkers noticed. The Register Guard reported that Robin O'Brien, Andrews' mother, says her son was shot after coworkers had teased the rapture believer. He'd been getting some ribbing from the guys in the shop, and I guess he simmered over that, she told the newspaper.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Harold Camping's stupidity is still far-reaching. So this guy who was shot, this Jerry Andrews, shot by his coworker, he actually has to have his shoulder medically repaired. Fortunately, he was not killed, which is great, but it basically destroyed his shoulder. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, this is another example of how there is demonstrable harm from Harold Camping's end-of-the-world predictions, from people taking these as gospel, so to say. You know, the man was so upset, obviously, when the rapture didn't come and the world did not end and he wasn't taken away, that just a little bit of teasing from his coworkers sent him over the edge.
Yeah.
Some of the simmering over this on the internet has been about, you know, well, maybe if you guys didn't make so much fun of the world ending, you know, this wouldn't happen. Well, you know, maybe if Harold Camping didn't suggest to his followers that they sell all their possessions and they get ready for the second coming and the end of the world, we wouldn't have this problem either.
Right. When you set people up to believe that everything is about to drastically change and then it fails to drastically change,
yeah,
that messes up your head quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I hardly think that the people who were, I mean, okay, it's not polite to tease people, sure. They shouldn't have been teasing him just because teasing is for jerks. But, you know, who bears the responsibility here? It's the guy who decided to pull the gun and shoot.
Yeah.
And you could argue, I think, somebody might be able to argue that he was encouraged in that by Harold Camping's ridiculous predictions.
I agree.
You know, I'd be interested to hear what a lawyer says about that. And that's really all. I think I'm kind of done with this one. How about you guys?
Yeah, moving on.
We've got some emails.
Let's have a little palate cleanser here.
Yeah.
We have an urgent email from Alex from the internet. Alex writes, "It's cool and all that you don't believe in God, but why be complete dosh bags about it? ?" Well, I'm not really sure how to answer that, but we get to be dosh bags because we have a radio show.
Okay.
I'm quite fond of being a dosh bag, actually, about this subject, because I like expressing my opinion on things just like every other human on the planet. And that's kind of what we're doing.
And this is something that Mike likes to talk about, the atheist visibility movement. The fact that we are atheists and the fact that we're willing to talk publicly about being an atheist and the fact that this is, you know, that we've chosen to do a show on this one, that's what makes us the dosh bag. It's not necessarily anything that we've said. It's not, and this is goes back again and again and again to Christian privilege. They believe they can live in this little bubble that allows them to never experience anything other than their particular brand of Christianity.
Right.
And when somebody around them says, "Hey, I'm an atheist," you're a dosh bag.
Yeah, and I have to say, in my opinion, we're probably the least doshiest of the visible atheist visibility people out there, although I will admit that when I just got smarmy just now and said that we get to be dosh bags because we have a radio show, that was pretty doshy of me.
So how dare you, Libby?
I apologize for my dosh baggery.
Well, sometimes if you're going to get the appellation, maybe you play a little ball. You know, okay, if you're already getting the heat for it, why not have some fun?
Yeah, and you know, that actually does sort of bring up a point, is that, you know, when atheists put up an innocuous billboard like the one that was just moved in, what was that, Ohio? It was one of the Freedom from Religion foundations. Yeah. All it said is, "I can be good without God." It had a smiling picture of a student, but it was so offensive, it had to be taken down. And, you know, even if we never said anything critical of religion at all we said was, "Hey, we're atheists and we're nice people," we would still get accused of being doshy.
And the other thing is, with the dosh bagger here, there's something going on specifically about this because it's Independence Day, is that American Atheists is going with the signs behind the planes.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to this. This is a really cool idea.
Yeah, I am too. And one of them was God. The original one was God Bless America. And apparently that was too dosh baggy because pilots wouldn't fly it because they couldn't wear a bulletproof vest all the time. Yeah, so, I mean, just saying that we're out there is dosh baggery.
Yeah. They ended up going with something else. I think it's atheism is patriotic.
That's correct.
Which I think is going to be should be really, really cool to see that flying up in the air on the 4th. I think it's a great idea. They got, 25 states.
Yeah.
That's
they're
correct.
Able to fly these in. So look out for them, people listening to the show here. Hopefully you'll see them snap a few pictures of the planes. It's pretty cool.
And if you know what dosh baggery means, give us a call, 253-584-1480. And we have one more email, and this is from Steve from Denver, Colorado, and it's about glossolalia. "I have been listening to the show for about 3 months and have been struggling with my theist upbringing for about 2 years now. This has led me away from my Pentecostal roots, my theology undergraduate degree, and also, unfortunately, has caused me to drift away from my family who don't accept my journey very well." I think it's a little bit more than upbringing when you've got an undergraduate degree in theology.
And that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah. That's a path. My question arises in the realm of speaking in tongues. I had a childhood experience that was relatively uncoerced when I was 10, in which I began speaking in tongues. I have found this is something I did in my prayer time, as well as in church services, usually quietly. Do you have any scientific findings that could help me explain why this is still present? I feel more distant than ever than from my theistic upbringing, but I cannot explain this weird happening.
That is interesting. Wow.
Have you experienced speaking in tongues ever?
I never have. I was raised in a Mormon family, and that's really not something that is done much in that religion.
This is something I've been really curious about because it's something my husband used to do. He was in the Pentecostal church as well, and he talks about, you know, speaking in tongues was a requirement in the Pentecostal religion to be saved. It literally was to them being filled with the Holy Spirit, and if you didn't, you know, speak in tongues, you were going to heck.
Yeah.
And I've been kind of looking into this, and I don't have any exact scientific information on it, but that there have been some studies where they look into the portion of the brain that's active with like an MRI or EEG or whatever, and there's a certain portion of the brain, kind of that spiritual, like, you know, connected to the universe, higher power sort of part of the brain,
right,
that is activated when you're doing the glossolalia, and it's an interesting, you know, phenomena. As for why you do it, I think it's understood that it's because you are expected to do it,
right,
and you are told that you have to, and so you actually subconsciously, you're not consciously going blah 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 blah. You're like, your subconscious is going, "We have to do this," and it goes blah 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 blah.
I'll be honest, my only experience with speaking in tongues in a religious context is with Jesus Camp, the movie, when one of the main features of that movie, you know, where she starts speaking in tongues. Now, there's this, I'm not an expert, but there are two runs here. One of them is glossolalia is a neuropsychological concept. Glossolalia is when the speech centers of your brain, the parts that actually form, basically make the mouth move and form the various phonemes, starts basically spitting out random data. And you start assembling it. A lot of kids do this. I did this, but I always thought it was like secret alien code and it was just make-believe. Now, the other thing is, he says he wasn't particularly coerced into speaking in tongues. The thing about coercion in this case is that coercion comes in many flavors. There's forcible coercion, where somebody's pressing specifically on you to do something. And another form of coercion is sort of the cultural coercion.
Right.
Is if he grew up in a Pentecostal environment and everybody around him was speaking in tongues and that was the thing to do.
Yeah, how would you not?
Right.
Yep.
And Now, there's one person in the Ask an Atheist group who has some experience with speaking in tongues, and I'd like to have him on the show and talk about this. But his case, his path out of religion involved glossolalia, which is when he recorded people who were speaking in tongues, played them back randomly for people, and said, "What was I saying there?" Or what was he saying there? What was I saying there?
Yeah.
It never matched up.
Yeah,
cool. Yeah, we
really, an interesting experiment that he did, and yeah, that was what led him to move away from religion, and now he's the president of the Seattle Skeptics.
Yeah, and past
really
president
work.
Of Seattle Atheists.
Yeah.
and a good friend.
All around great guy. We like Case.
So we have a caller, and this is Manolo from Kentucky, and he's got a question about dosh bags. How you doing there, Manolo?
Well, it wasn't actually a question. I just wanted to make some comments about that email because I get that all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you got?
Well, people tell me that all the time, and I think the mere existence of us atheists, I think, is bothersome to them, to people that are religious.
Exactly.
I think that's part of the problem. You know, and then they tell you, like, it's okay as long as you don't, you know, say it or be open about it. You know, you can believe whatever you want. And I compare it to when they tell somebody that is gay, it's okay to be gay, but just don't act gay.
Yeah. That's true.
It's the same thing, you know, and it's ridiculous. How can you ask somebody, you know, you can have opinions about everything.
Yeah.
They don't do that with politics. They don't do that with anything else except with religion. With religion, it seems to be like an off topic that nobody is allowed to talk about.
Yeah, it's privileged protectionism, you know, is that, you know, they believe that their religion says that homosexuality is bad, so, but they're liberal and they want to live and let live, but if it enters in their environment, they're going to attack it like an immune system. The same thing with atheism.
Yeah, Manolo, maybe you've had a similar experience to this, I don't know, but back when I was religious, I would actually, I had a lot of atheist friends. I never tried to stop them from talking about their atheism, but I always felt kind of uncomfortable with it, and eventually I was able to identify. I felt uncomfortable because I realized that could so easily be me. You know, they have pretty good reasons for not believing in God, and what are my reasons for believing in God? I could be an atheist too, and that idea made me a little uncomfortable, and it always made me feel a little bit weird about discussing religion and atheism with my non-believer friends. Maybe that's what's going through these people's heads, that they're kind of thinking, literally, there but for the grace of God go I.
And a recent...
Most of the time, it's so hard to you know, not contradict our arguments that it's very, very uncomfortable for them to just talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a recent discussion with a believer, somebody I'm friends with, I was speaking to, and she said, you know, that the problem with us talking about what we believe is because I think she's wrong. And I was thinking, well, yeah, I mean, I do think she's wrong. I don't not respect her or like her as a person because of that. But the key is she thinks I'm wrong, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else?
Go ahead. Not only you're wrong, you're going to hell.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, yeah.
And, you know, you're supposed to say, oh, you know, God is great and he's awesome, but you're going to hell.
Yeah. That's what it all boils down to.
All right. Well, it's good hearing you again, Manolo. Talk to you soon.
Take care, man.
You too.
Bye.
Bye. Manolo is one of the people behind podcast ATRZR, Spanish language podcast about atheism. And you should check it out. I know Becky listens to it. I have a little trouble with it, not being bilingual. But,
right, me too. But I'm sure glad they're out there doing their thing.
Yeah. And I mean, we've really become about the protectionism lately on the show. Is this idea that just because you're a Christian means in this country for a long time has meant you got to live in this bubble where nothing, you know.
Right.
The freedom of speech and freedom of expression does not mean a womb. You know, you don't get
exactly
to live.
Right.
That's what it comes down to.
The Constitution is not your spiritual egg carton.
But so going back to this glossolalia thing, Case definitely has some stories about that. And there is a psychological basis for glossolalia. And I don't remember a lot of the things about it. But, Steve, you should look into that. You know, with you definitely have a scholarly bent. So, you know, that's one place you could definitely look. And
yeah,
check
into it. It is a fascinating subject.
He also says some very nice things about Ask an Atheist. And
aww,
thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Yay.
Well, I'm pretty excited about our topic today.
I think I'm excited about our topic, too.
I'm getting a little too excited.
Well, we're going to be going into a break, but in a moment... Oop.
Whoa, hey.
Whoa, wrong one.
Everyone got too excited.
Yeah, it's breaking. Everything's breaking. It's broken on fire. Help me. Yeah, so we're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we'll get into our topic, and we'll have Daryl Ray on.
Good times.
All right, see you in a minute.
The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of free thinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. Come celebrate life with us. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking and hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. You can become a member of the Humanists of Washington at humanistsofwashington.org. You'll get our quarterly publication, The Secular Humanist Press. Check out meetup.com where you can be part of our monthly Seattle dinner and our Heathens Do It Better breakfast. Humanists of Washington.
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an essential part of your business marketing, but that's not all. Want VoIP? We've got it, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to make your business communications succeed effortlessly. At Tacoma Telematics, we're committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
And after that explosion of incompetence, this is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480, and we've got a phone call from London, but we're going to have to take it very quick. Again, this is Mick from London, and he's got a question about evidence of atheism as a possible religion. How you doing?
Hi, how you going? Okay. Could atheism be like a Buddhist religion? They've got some good things about it. It's they've got secularism. This is the one and only true life. Could atheism be a type of Buddhism?
Well, most forms of Buddhism are a type of atheism. I think what the problem with defining atheism as a religion is that all atheism really describes is whether someone believes in a god or not. It doesn't necessarily describe someone's beliefs when it comes to humanism, your beliefs about how the world should function, your beliefs about the origin of the cosmos, all that stuff that religions tend to address, including Buddhism. So, I don't know, the idea has merit, but I think in most cases...
I was just thinking of Richard Dawkins. I think he's pushing towards that.
Really? What makes you say that?
Just watch him on YouTube. I'd say he's an angry atheist who's like giving, another version of religion, which is probably... Well, it's not religion, is it? Buddhism. It's an atheist religion. An atheist way of life.
Yeah.
And I think that'd be a lot better than most.
I think we're gonna have to wrap up this call, but I hear your point, and that's something I hear a lot. Thank you for your call. But what we're coming up against here is that this is something that religious people push on him a lot, is that he's offering another ideology. And the difference between between Buddhism and atheism with, you know, humanism behind it is the evidence for what we see.
Right. And I think Richard Dawkins, like all the other visible atheists out there, he is expressing his opinion about the way the world is, the way he hopes the world ought to be. I don't think he's necessarily trying to convince people that they need to approach the world or even atheism in the same way he does.
Yeah.
That's not the impression I've ever gotten anyway.
Yeah, he seems to be just offering his own opinion and not actually very many opinions in general, but
yeah,
I'll figure.
So we should get on to our interview here. And with us today is Dr. Daryl Ray. He's the founder of RecoveringReligionists.com, which is a network of meetup groups, and the author of the book, The God Virus. And he was recently completed a study on sex and secularism. How are you doing today?
Fine.
Hey, Dr. Ray.
Hi, Daryl.
Hi, guys. Good to be on.
It's great to talk to you again. For those of you who don't know, Daryl Ray sponsors our podcast, Living After Faith, and so we speak to him all the time. We have interviewed him about the sex and secularism study as well, and we're going to get into it today. He's a fantastic guy.
Yeah, it's a really great study that you did. Really exciting. I actually participated in it myself. I answered some questions.
So me too.
Why don't you explain this study for us, for those of us who are a little unfamiliar with it?
Well, there's, to date, at least until we did this, there was really no research asking what happened to people when they left religion. We can find no other research at all. So we thought, this is a pretty interesting idea, since so many people are leaving religion right now, and virtually every religion you can name is consumed with sex,
yes,
or at least controlling sex.
Yeah.
So you put those two together, and it seems to me the obvious thing to be studying is, you know, what happens when you leave religion? Because a lot of people complain about how sexually oppressive and judgmental religious people are.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure. It's
definitely been coming up in the media lately. So how did you put this study together?
Well, Amanda and I put our heads together. I was doing kind of a preliminary study, and she and I connected, and she helped me put 69 questions together. And that was that was accidental. I want you to know that.
Sure, it
she
was.
She called me up one night after we'd finished and said, "Do you realize we have 69 questions?" And, "No, I didn't."
That's great.
But it's appropriate. So, well, you know, we tested the questions on 21 experts and people we respected in the field. And then we put it up to kind of do a second test. We thought we'd get a couple hundred people and then make sure everything was working right. The next morning we woke up and 2,500 people had taken
Wow. Nice.
It had gone viral and we couldn't stop it. So we probably would have worded some questions a little differently, but all in all, it still came out very well. We were really surprised. But the biggest surprise was 14,560 people took the darn thing.
Wow, that was your total number.
That is some data points.
I understand you got ferangulated, and that helped with getting responses.
We sent it to PZ after it had been up about 4 days. We sent PZ a notification, and he put it up, and the next morning I woke up, and there's like 4,000 more up there. I mean, yeah, you get ferangulated, I guess that could be a good thing in this case.
Yeah, yeah.
So clearly, this went viral, which means that you had the survey done on the Internet.
Yes, and we were really concerned that people wouldn't take it or wouldn't get a very good sample, because it took 45 minutes to an hour to take this thing.
Wow.
We gave people plenty of opportunity to write comments. It wasn't just on a scale of 1 to 10, answer this question. After you've done the scale of 1 to 10, you can now feel free to write your comments. And we got 4,000 comments, and some of these comments are a page or two long.
I mean, wow.
We have thousands of pages of text that we have not had time to analyze yet. So we've just done the quantitative analysis, not the qualitative analysis. But the two go hand in hand, and there's a lot of qualitative stuff that tells us, you know, you get a certain number. It doesn't tell you that what's going behind that number. You know, for example, we found that 29% of former secularists are kinky and have a fetish.
Wow, okay.
So we had to go to the textual side of it to find out what those 29% were doing. And that was fascinating. We did that quite a bit.
I bet that would be some very entertaining reading. I have
was.
A question
we
for
learned,
you.
We learned new words we didn't know.
Don't say that.
They're probably not safe for the air.
We're on commercial radio.
Yes, that's true.
But I do actually have a question, because a lot of our listeners are really into this kind of thing. What kind of controls did you put in this study?
Well, there's actually quite a few. It's not randomized. Let's get right off. That's one of our biggest criticisms. But there's no such thing as a randomized survey of sex.
I mean,
you can't do that. Nobody's ever done that. Even Kinsey didn't do that. So,
right.
So when we get criticized for not having a randomized survey, you know, I just blow it off because nobody has them.
Yeah.
But this is an enormous sample, and there's several controls. There's some internal controls, and there's some external control. Let's talk about the external controls first. We put our data up against the Pew Memorial Trust sex survey, the ARIS sex survey, and the Abstinence Only sex survey. Half a billion of your dollars went into
Yeah.
Abstinence Only. So we've got all that external data to compare our data to. Because if our people are outliers, you know, if all these people are now secularists or just really crazed sex addicts or something, you know, we would be able to see, we'd be able to see that they're different from those other three huge, major, multi-million-dollar studies.
Right.
And what we found was there's almost no difference whatsoever between
wow.
our sample and their sample. So that's a check that tells us we're getting pretty normal human beings who just happen to have left religion. That's
okay.
an external check.
Makes sense.
There's a number of internal checks because a lot of our questions were designed to elicit differences. So, for example, one of the main graphs, one of the first graphs in our report, and people can download this report, by the way, for free at ipcpress.com.
Okay.
But if you download and look at the report, you'll see a graph that says sexual guilt by denomination. You know, we asked people, what denomination were you raised in? In one question, you know, 10 questions later, we asked, how much guilt were you taught as a child in your home of origin? And we simply took those two numbers and correlated them and looked at them, and we found really interesting differences by denomination. It's another check. You know, it's not just all atheists are now having all the sex they want. It's all atheists who were formerly religious have different varying degrees of guilt, had different degrees of guilt, and you can actually tell by denomination. Now, here's a trick
wow.
question for you. What's the most guilt-ridden religion, according to our data?
I'm kind of afraid to answer this question.
I mean, I could go the stand-up comedian route and say Catholicism.
Exactly, and that's what a lot of people say. That the number one guilt-ridden religion is Mormonism.
I'm a former Mormon. I could have answered that one.
Yeah. But right behind them, and just by a hair's breadth, are the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Pentecostals, and the Seventh-day Adventists.
Interesting. Everybody who came out of the burned-over district.
You
got it. That's exactly right.
Wow.
And Catholics are about 60%. You know, they're in the low end of the top group, if you will. But here's the real trick question. What's the least guilty religion?
Atheism.
I would be inclined to say atheists.
Oh, yeah, and you would be wrong.
Are you serious? Who was it?
Unitarians?
Unitarians. Unitarians were lower by about a quarter of a point than atheists and agnostics.
So, wow.
And yes, isn't that interesting?
There
were some real surprises in our data.
I think that's interesting because they're coming out of a... they're not. And the thing about atheism is that we have people who were ex-religionists and were in groups that were in that top 10 that he was talking about coming out of atheism, so it makes sense that they would carry some guilt with them, where the Unitarian Church doesn't really, you know, they don't really get into that sexual control thing the same way.
Yeah,
do you get
true.
More
no,
guilty
don't.
When you come out of Unitarianism?
That's a good one for your next study.
Well, what we found was we gathered a ton of data. I mean, just much more than simply sex. What we also found was who's feeding atheism right now. And the one group that's feeding atheism more than any other group by three times are non-denominational Christians.
Interesting. That's really cool that you guys were able to pick up sort of a side effect of your study and analyze a totally different data point.
That's really cool. I think those non-denominational Christians are what I usually call on the show ethnic Christians just because of what their family are.
Huh.
Well, no, these are mega church. These are mega church people. These are evangelicals. No, these are the people that are, you know, going nuts about the gays and stuff right now. But when they... What happens when you get through with all that crazy waving your hands around and trying to figure out all the other stuff those evangelicals say? Well, what happens when you get tired of that? You know, there's nowhere else to go. They don't go back to being Episcopalians or Methodists. That's for sure.
True, yeah.
Right.
So they move on to us. So the reason I brought that up is because if I ask people, what's the group that's feeding us most? Some people say Unitarians. But that is not the case. Unitarians are staying put, and they ought to because there's no benefit for leaving the Unitarians. You just might get more guilt when you leave.
Yeah.
So, sexual guilt. So I've asked a number of Unitarians, why do you think Unitarians would have less guilt than anybody, including atheists and agnostics? And they tell me that Unitarian Church has a very effective sex education program that they teach inside their church. It's very sex positive.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I didn't either. And as they describe it, it sounds they deal with gays and lesbians and transgender and all that stuff very openly and very non-judgmentally. Well, if you think about it, we atheists and agnostics, freethinkers, we don't have a place to send our kids.
Right.
That's true.
To get that kind of education. And the Unitarians do. So they're a leg up on us there, and I think they deserve credit and kudos for the efforts they're doing.
The interesting thing about Unitarian Universalism is that there's really two sides of it. There's the Unitarianism, which is, you know, they was a Christian denomination that didn't believe in the Trinity. The Universalist side is more of a it's sort of extreme ecumenicalism, where everybody has a place at the table, and there are even atheist Unitarian ministers. So you don't actually have to abide by any ideology. I looked into it myself, but to become a clergyman in a Unitarian church still involves 3 years of Bible study, which I wasn't too interested in, as you might imagine.
That's a rough 3 years.
Right.
So what other surprises did you find in this study?
Well, we found probably the biggest confirmation in some ways and surprise in other ways was, when do people start sexual activity? We out of 14,500 people, we had a big enough sample we could slice and dice it in some very interesting ways. So what we did was we asked people on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how religious was your childhood home, and then we split the group. Those who said they were 1, 2, or 3 were raised pretty secular. Those who said they were 8, 9, or 10 were raised pretty religious. So we just split those and said, okay, let's look at those people. And we asked four questions of everybody. When did you start masturbating? When did you start petting? When did you start oral sex? And when did you start intercourse? And then we correlated that against how religious they were raised. And here's the big surprise, is no surprise. They all start at the same time.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
It's just who is lying about it, I think.
Exactly.
The abstinence-only research shows the same thing. Now, the abstinence-only research shows that if you put a kid, a teenager, through an abstinence-only course, it will slow them down by 3 to 5 months in starting intercourse. And they won't be using condoms because they're so misinformed.
So half $1 billion for 5 months.
Yeah, right.
Nice.
But 5 months, that increases STDs and teenage pregnancy.
Hooray!
People who go through abstinence-only courses tend to have higher STDs and higher teenage pregnancies. And you can just plot teenage pregnancies and STDs by religiosity throughout the nation. Where's the highest incidence? It's in the South, in Oklahoma, it's in Mississippi. Wherever you got high religiosity, you've also got high abstinence-only training, and you got high other things.
Wow.
But our research shows the same thing. There's no difference in any of those four things I named until age 18. And at about age 18, we see the religious people are slightly behind, about 10% behind, the non-religiously raised people. But by 21, they're all caught up.
Huh.
So it's the same thing the abstinence-only shows, just almost no difference. And what we conclude out of that, Amanda and I conclude on this, is biology happens.
Yeah.
Period. It's a pretty simple message. You can teach and preach all you want, but they're still going to start doing those four things just the same as everybody else.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to argue with biology.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I had abstinence only, or not abstinence only, but abstinence as a an addition to my regular sex education in junior high school. And, you know, it was a lot like you would imagine, you know, yuppie school in the, you know, the greater Puget Sound area. They didn't mention God, but they were like very, you know, abstinence is pretty much the only way. And
after,
they had these weird exercises they wanted you to do. And anyways, after the program was over, after class, a couple of us went up and asked the women who were teaching the class, so was it really hard to be abstinent until you were married? You guys did, right?
Ah, I love it, yeah.
And of course they said, well, no. We're like, well, what are you doing teaching us this? I mean, if you couldn't resist, if it's so important you're running around telling us to be abstinent, why are you trying to tell us what to do? You know how hard it is.
If I hope your readers will read the report, because the end of the report asked that very question, Deanna Joy. I think that's the question we ought to be asking. All these people, preachers, ministers, Sunday school teachers, abstinence-only teachers, are all telling kids to do what they themselves couldn't do.
Wow.
So
wow.
It's gross hypocrisy. And if you look at it this way, being religious means you lead a double life. and I'm serious, you lead a double life if you're religious. Here's what I mean. You're telling kids masturbation is wrong, even as you go home and do it yourself. You're telling kids do not start sex before marriage, even as you did it yourself. You're telling kids don't use condoms, even as you did it yourself. So you're telling kids one thing, and you're living a public life, even as you're going home and doing other things. Pornography, for example. Most religions say pornography is wrong, it's terrible, and yet our data and all the other research data shows religious people actually use pornography more than non-religious people do.
We're going to talk about that.
Yeah, we actually have that
later in the show.
Later
yeah.
in our show. So
well, I understand that you're using...
Our data shows that. Our data shows pornography is higher use among religious people. If you have...
We're starting to run out of time, but Daryl, you're going to be using this study for a book. Can you tell us what that book is, how that book is going to use a study?
I'm working on my next book, to be called Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. And this is just a tiny part of the book. It's just going to be woven into some of our other conclusions. But we're just trying to look at how religion impacts sexuality. And most people have no idea how much their sexuality has been impacted. It's huge. It's gigantic. And what I find amazing is how little atheists know that their own sexuality, even people who are raised atheists, their sexuality has been dramatically impacted oftentimes by religiosity of our culture.
Yeah.
And, of course, the religiosity of our culture reduces choices and options for people, or tries to. So that's what I'm exploring. How's religion just infecting everything about our sexuality?
Very nice.
And
Dr. Wright, thank you very much for your time. This has been a very enlightening interview for me.
Yeah, thank you.
Good. Well, I hope you'll get online and read it. And
it's
happy
awesome.
To answer questions.
I fully intend to. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. We're going to go into another break, and then in a moment we will be talking about everybody's favorite subject.
Sex!
Yay!
The end of the world is nigh. Millions will disappear in the rapture, and those left behind will feel the wrath of God.
So who better to help those people feeling the wrath than an atheist? We don't believe in God, so we're pretty sure we won't get raptured out of here.
You can help by donating to Rapture Relief.
We'll use the money to help those afflicted during Armageddon.
And if for some reason this all turns out to be just another failed prophecy, your money won't be wasted.
We'll give it to Camp Quest, which teaches children critical thinking and science so they won't be duped by religious fables in the first place.
Learn more at rapture-relief.org.
A satirical benefit for Camp Quest, brought to you by Seattle Atheists.
Join the Ask an Atheist after party at Doyle's Public House. The Ask an Atheist crew will be there at 5 for good beers, food, and you're invited. You'll find a dozen beers on tap, including Stella, Guinness, Smithwick's Irish Ale, Twisted Thistle IPA, and Fuller's London Porter, as well as dozens of domestic and imported beers and bottles. Join us for Good Atheist Conversation and meet the crew today at 5 at Doyle's, 208 St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma.
If you enjoy the programming we create here on Ask an Atheist, please make a contribution with us. Your sponsorship helps keep our show on the air and improve the quality of our broadcasts. Donors get access to exclusive Ask an Atheist content. Don't make us beg. Please go to askanatheist.tv and contribute today.
Ask an Atheist.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of hot.
Absolutely.
253-584-1480. One of the interesting things we were talking about in the interview was that how religion continues to affect the sexual culture of atheism.
Yeah. That was an interesting point he brought up.
And this is something you can really speak about because you lived in a religion pretty strongly.
Yes, I mean, I was not at all surprised to learn that Mormons had the biggest problem with sexual guilt. And I have to say, I was a rarity, I think, among people who were raised Mormon. I'm not really sure why that is, because I had no guilt whatsoever about exploring sexuality from a relatively young age. I was about 15.
Right.
I had no problem with it. None. I don't recall ever having a moment where I was like, ooh, I really shouldn't be doing this. All I really thought was, it's no one's business.
Yeah.
Stay out of my business, people. Stay out. I kept it to myself because I didn't want the rest of my community and my family and whatnot to find out exactly what was going on. But I didn't have a problem with it. And I'm not really sure what to attribute that to, because I still to this day know adult Mormons, even in married relationships, who have serious problems with their sexuality. And it's interesting because Mormonism teaches you, they're very big on the abstinence only pre-marriage thing. They actually, in one of the teachings that are written specifically to young people, they actually say that the only sin worse than sexual impurity is murder. That sexual impurity is almost as bad as killing someone.
Wow.
Wow.
But then they encourage you, once you're married, to enjoy your sex life fully. After you're raised that way, how can you?
I wondered about that, because clearly, I mean, my experiences in Arizona told me that Mormons tend to be pretty happy about the sex. They definitely have a lot of kids,
yeah.
And you can't get one without the other. But you say it's abstinence, abstinence, abstinence until marriage.
Abstinence until marriage, and then you're supposed to enjoy sex, but only certain kinds of sex. Like, you know, you're basically taught that certain kinds of sexual activity are okay, other kinds are definitely not okay and are considered sinful. I mean, there's still so many restrictions put on a relationship, even with a spouse, you know, that you're married to. It's strange. I mean, all I can really say is that the Mormon approach to sex is strange. It's messed up in some fundamental ways. And I feel really lucky that I think it has to do with the fact that I have a really liberal mom.
Yeah.
I didn't end up with any of that guilt. And I feel lucky because of that, because I've seen it ruin some people's sex lives.
Yeah, we've had a lot of feedback on Living After Faith, because we talk about sex a lot. And a lot of people have expressed the same thing, that a big part of it is that before marriage, you get nothing, no contact, don't even think about sex. And it's hard to flip that switch on in your brain and go, okay, sex is okay now. And so you have a lot of dysfunction, a lot of inability to, you know, get into a mood or an ability to perform.
Yeah, very difficult.
So as you might imagine, this topic has been generating a lot of interest, and people want to talk to us about it. And this is Jackson in San Antonio, and you'd like to talk about sex education. How are you?
I'm doing well. I think it's really important that when you're talking about sex education and religious attitudes towards sex, you've got to talk about sexism. I was talking to a friend of mine about her sex ed courses, because, you know, they split the boys from the girls for that.
Yeah.
And she said that the teacher had a flower at the front of the room, and she would pull the petals off one by one. And say that each petal that she pulled off represented sexual contact with a man. And then she showed the flower with all the petals removed. It was, you know, wilting. It was horrible. And she said, is this really all you want to be able to offer your husband when you marry him?
Oh, God.
That's lovely.
I mean, I've heard some creepy things up there, but that there's sort of a psychological edge
that
to that.
That is really weird. And let me just say, if I could be in that woman's classroom, I would love to tell her, yeah, but you know what? That flower had a good time before it got married. Before it got all wilted.
That is disturbing.
And it's just,
that is disturbing.
The idea is, you know, what you're bringing to the marriage with your husband is your sexuality. And that's your job when you're
That is real. That's disturbing on so many levels.
And to bring this back to sex, it's really the job. When you get into a sexual relationship, both partners are coming into it. You know, they're both bringing their experiences to it and their attitudes towards it. So it's not just, and this is something that they really push on women that they don't push on men.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I had a pretty liberal sex education in my school in Northern Illinois. But and they never really pulled anything like this. They said, you know, limit the number of partners you had, because, you know, really it's best for marriage. But they never said, and they, I'd never heard of anything like this happening.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
And
that's...
I'm trying to extend this metaphor to turn it into something that could explain my experience with sex education, but all the metaphors I'm coming with aren't really good for radio. So
we got to keep it clean, so
yeah.
The idea that a woman is ruined by sexual contact, yeah. You know, that's an old-fashioned word for a woman who has had sexual contact. I mean, that's part and parcel with that flower analogy, and that's always disturbed me.
Jackson, thank you very much for that little nightmare.
Yeah,
I that sounds kind of negative, but I appreciate it. It's weird to hear that stuff. That hasn't been my experience, and
scary.
All right, we got another call. And this is, strangely enough, Deanna from Kansas, and she has a comment on abstinence education. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. The last caller actually sparked my memory. I had the flower experience, too.
No way!
I've lived in Kansas my whole life.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty unfortunate. But I wanted to say, express to Dr. Ray how fantastic it is that somebody has finally conducted a study about this.
Yeah.
Because I have seen it and seen it and seen it with friends around me. We were all raised religious, most of us Mennonite in my community. And like you guys were saying... I did. I always felt different because I was not uncomfortable with sexuality. Not at all.
I don't know what that is, Deanna. I think in some people, maybe just the biological drive just overcomes the religious programming for guilt.
It almost has to. It almost has to, because I have seen, I hate to say ruination, but dramatic events happen in the lives of friends that wouldn't necessarily have happened had they had appropriate sex education without religious bias.
Exactly. When you push and push and push and try to make sexuality and to ignore the biological impetus being given to you by your body, and when you push that all away for the purposes of social control, that means you are incredibly unprepared for what happens when that pent-up biological energy finally starts wearing away at you as your belief in religion or your belief in faith starts to wear away. And eventually it's going to explode, if you will, into some really irresponsible behaviors.
It's like the dam breaking on the Catholic schoolgirl example everybody always gives, is once you remove that wall,
all bets are off.
And it's especially rougher. I grew up in a very small town of about 1,000 people where we were all Mennonite. There were really no atheists. There were no other religions.
Right.
Certainly no one who would admit to not believing, even having doubts about belief. So you're in this microcosm, and I think this happens a lot. You're in this microcosm of your school or your community where everybody shares these beliefs, and it is like you guys were saying, or like the caller from London was saying earlier, that you're closeted.
Yeah.
You're closeted as a sexual person, and you're closeted as someone who might have the audacity to think differently.
True. Quite. True.
Well, thank you for your call, Deanna.
Thank you so much for this program. I've just recently discovered you guys. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much. And
thank you.
Try to have some fun out in Kansas.
Right? Oh, I do. My flowers having lots of fun. Don't worry.
Right on.
All right. So our next caller goodbye. Our next caller is Violet from Georgia, and she's got a comment about a recent blog post that Becky put on the AskAnAtheist.tv website. How are you, Violet?
Hi! I'm doing great. You have no idea how hard I've been fangirling for the past hour. But I came across Becky's article, and I wanted to comment about it because I had read both the excerpt and the critique by Jen, and the reason that I wanted to say something was that if you get a chance, the readers out there, you should read the article. It's the first article up on AskAnAtheist.tv.
Yes, it is.
And it has both a link to Jen, and then Jen has a link to the excerpt.
Right.
Yeah.
The excerpt sounds word for word like what I had to go through in Harlem, Georgia, sex education. It was all about, these are pictures of diseased organs, of all of these diseases that have been left to advance for 15 years. And it was all about how, sex is going to kill you, and how you're going to be heartbroken and miserable, and you're going to live alone with 50 cats. kind of thing. You have sex before you're married.
Right.
Yeah.
And the tone is exactly the same, and so it does... It feels like you're back in that classroom when you're reading this excerpt.
I kind of have to disagree with you there, and that was something that Becky... one of the reasons she disagreed is, for the record, Becky is the daughter of someone who taught sex education in West Virginia. And the situation in West Virginia is much like a lot of the places that you'll find in the South where they teach abstinence-only education. And Becky's mother was brought in basically to teach something other than abstinence. And so she did see a lot of that. And I think some of that might be just... I don't want to be negative about anything, because I think ultimately all four parties or five or six, you know, everybody involved basically wants the same sort of sex positive culture, but might not what that article and the way it was worded, might that not have your experiences has colored your interpretation of that?
And that's possible. And I think the distinction that she made, beside saying that it doesn't need to be specific, because she doesn't have the specific information about, say, how to divide your finances when you get married.
Yeah,
right.
The reason you have to work so hard at being sex positive is that everybody else is so sex negative.
Yeah.
I think the article would work really well in the idealistic world where no one judges anyone for sex.
Right. Violet, you called and left us a voicemail earlier, like right before we were about to head to the station to do the show. And the thing that really struck me about the voicemail you left was where you said, even for people who want to go out and educate themselves and find more information about sex, there's a stigma against you in so many places. I think it's easy for us in Seattle to kind of forget that because we tend to be a very liberal community. But in places like Georgia, where you're from, it's harder for kids to go out and educate themselves about sex. If they're seen going into a Planned Parenthood to go get some free condoms or to get some birth control pills, you know, there's a stigma on them. There's a social stigma around that. And it is hard to feel like it's okay to be sex positive when everyone around you is telling you to be sex negative.
Sure. And I think if the excerpt was taken in a vacuum, it would have been, you know, it would be pretty negative. But it was one section of a much larger paper, which was incredible, which was pretty sex positive. And also in the article that Becky wrote later on, there's a paragraph that sounds exactly like the kind of thing that Jen McRight and we want from the person who wrote that part about disease. And my thing is that we are atheists, we are skeptics, we are about the evidence. And if we have to fight the negative emotionality that people heap upon sex with only our own emotionality and without facts, I kind of wonder if we're really fighting the fight in a way that's not dogmatic.
Oh, yeah, but it would be, I think... It's not so much, I don't know that she had, well, Jen McRight did come back with statistics and things like that. And part of what gives it the feeling of the, there's not a lot of the actual excerpt in Becky's article. And part of what gives it the feeling of an abstinence-only class is some of the stuff she left out. Like, it talks about how you're going to be miserable if you have sex, she didn't say expecting something different, but something about casual sex. And I think one of the important things that Jen mentioned specifically is negotiation. I think the most important thing of any sexual encounter is sitting down and saying, what do you want from this, and what do I want from this, and how can we work this out? And the excerpt doesn't have that in it, and that is a major component of the abstinence-only.
But the paper itself did.
Yeah.
The paper was the whole paper was very clear about the negotiations involved. I find.
Oh, so like the entire book is?
The whole part of it is taken alone. That particular segment does sound very negative, but that segment didn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah, good to remember.
Maybe I'll have
to
go check out the book and see.
There's a lot of it online. We're kind of running up to the end of the hour, so
yes.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thanks,
Violet.
Really enjoyed the debate. And, you know, Becky is sort of taking Jen McRight to, you know, on in sort of disagreement here. But on the other hand, we all want the same thing. So
true.
Yep.
Maybe we just have different approaches to it. We'll work out all the kinks to it. Maybe we all just need to sit down and say, what do you want from this?
It's one of the things I love about the atheist community is we can all disagree on things and argue about stuff and present our evidence and take apart other people's evidence. But at the end of the day, we generally kind of have an overarching theme that we all want to go through. And yeah. I think a big part of it is that we don't want to be super emotional and scare tactic-y with our sex ed. We want to present the evidence, but we want to do it in a balanced way, and we're all about that.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. This has been a really popular topic.
I
guess it just proves that everyone loves to talk about the deed.
That's for sure. You should see my email box. Everybody wants to tell me about their sex difficulties associated with religion, and I find it fascinating. Don't stop people.
my experience, and that was kind of weird, is that I grew up kind of a nerd, if you can't tell. And all of surprise. And all of my heroes, the people I looked up to locally, were all sort of the technical free floating bachelor guys who went on vacations whenever they wanted to,
yeah,
and did weird technical things and had huge radio equipment or recorded, you know, old radio show collections and stuff like that. And they were happy, and I figured, well, given my hobbies, I'm probably going to be more like that than anything else. So I just didn't worry about sex at all. So when it finally entered the sort of the personal equation for me, it was, I guess I'll just incorporate that into my life. And
that's a good balance. That's a good balanced approach to take toward it, really.
I've always been a huge nerd myself, but I was just lucky to have been born a female nerd, so it was a lot easier to get laid over the years.
It's true. Female nerds have a much easier time than male nerds. I think that's an indisputable scientific fact.
Yeah, yes. I agree. All right, that's about what we got time for today. My name is Sam Olvey. Thank you very much, Deanna. Deanna Joy Lyons, thank you very much, Libby.
No problem.
Our call screener today was Jerry Schiffelbein. Our production assistant was Rebecca Friedman. Music is by Chris Cullman, and that music in this third segment was Take Me Now from Nick Chapman from Waka Chica Waka Chica, porn music for the masses. This is an NEDM Media presentation. See you next week.